Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Is Swahili a language of the colonial project or the anti-colonial pan-Africanist language par excellence? In other words, is Swahili a language of freedom or is it a language of control? This, writes Morgan Robinson, is the question upon which her book pivots. A Language for the World, The Standardization of Swahili, explores the tensions inherent in standardization, a process never fully completed but always imagined as final. Spanning the century between 1864 and 1964, A Language for the World offers an original, deeply researched history of the way one island dialect of Swahili came to be the standard. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Today, as I just mentioned, my guest is Morgan J. Robinson. Morgan is an assistant professor specializing in African history and the history of science at Mississippi State University. Morgan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Morgs, this is just a delight to have you on because we first met in 2013 when I began graduate school at Princeton and you were my senior by a year. And we have been talking about this project since. So it's a 10-year anniversary.
It is.
And I am absolutely delighted to be able to talk with you about your new book.
Yeah. And
as we're thinking about starting this conversation, you know, I was thinking, I think I know where this project comes from and how Morgan came to it. And then I was thinking, maybe I don't know as much as I wish I did. So tell us, remind me and tell our listeners what drew you to this project.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You're right that these dissertations that turn into books often feel kind of, it becomes kind of naturalized, right? Of course, I write about language and I'm interested in histories of communication. But it really all started because of my own felt linguistic shortcomings. I took Swahili in college and I love language learning, but I have no real talent for it. And so often I would be kind of, you're sort of reading this literature about particularly mission histories. And even once you get into the documents and they're like, well, the missionaries came, they learned the language, and then they used that language to save souls. And I think to myself, how did they just learn the language? I mean, they did not have semester-long courses or Duolingo or any of the things that we have today to learn language. And so it was really that almost selfish interest in the process of language learning that made me most curious to dig into this, the history of the language.
And when did you first go to Zanzibar and start working on the archives there?
Yeah, my first trip to Tanzania was not archival at all. It was the trip of a naive 19-year-old. When I went to Tanzania, I was in Dar es Salaam for a summer, volunteering to teach English. Not well, I'm sure. But my first archival trip to Zanzibar was probably the summer of 2012. For a quick initial trip to the archives and then have been back to Zanzibar since subsequently a couple of times and then spent some time in the National Archives in Dar es Salaam as well.
So as you said, in retrospect, it becomes naturalized that this is the project, you know, that we've been working on, but it always has an origin story. And before we get into the kind of meatier arguments of your book, I wanted to set the scene a little bit for listeners who aren't as familiar as we are now that you've written it and I've read it. So your book starts in 1864 and it starts on Zanzibar. Mm-hmm. And as we said, it's a history of Swahili. And I wanted you to kind of lay the landscape out for us a little bit. Who's speaking Swahili? What is the history of Swahili up to this point in the mid-1860s?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. By this period, and really by the early 1800s, Swahili had become the lingua franca, the language of commerce and exchange across the region of East Central Africa. So from the coast all the way in towards the Great Lakes. And this was, it was carried on the caravan trade routes, right? People in this era are trading everything from enslaved people to tusks, to elephant tusks, in exchange for things that are coming in from the coast, including dates. And we have other sort of trade goods that are being brought into the interior in exchange for these often sort of luxury items that are being sent out into the Indian Ocean world. So by the 1860s, Swahili really is, and particularly the dialect spoken on Zanzibar, is recognized as the trade lingua franca, the economically and in some ways politically powerful dialect of the entire region. And so then when you get European intermediaries getting into the game by this period, because in the 1860s, Zanzibar was one of the main trade entrepôts of the Western Indian Ocean, then the missionaries also start getting involved. They are starting to look for what could be a possible language of communication. And so for them too, Swahili did seem to be the most practical answer, to be sure.
Well, just in these first, you know, years of your book, Swahili is already presenting this opportunity and dilemma, in a sense, for the historian, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. it's a language that is connecting through trade, but it's also a language that is connecting trade to facilitate the trade of enslaved people.
Absolutely.
It's a language that's used at the court of the Omani Sultan in Zanzibar, mm-hmm. not particularly enlightened regime. Mm-hmm. And it's offering the possibility of missionaries to learn a language with which they can, you know, propagate their faith.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it is a continued point of friction when we talk about Swahili. In some places, including large parts of Uganda, for instance, the language of Swahili is still associated by some people with the trade in enslaved people to this day. Idi Amin's regime also did not help with the reputation of this language. It was used by the police force and the army under Idi Amin's regime. So the reputation of this language, right, which if you talk to any sociolinguist, which I am absolutely not, but the prestige of particular languages and the reputation that languages have within various registers and among various speakers, we can be talking about the same language and have very different kind of associations with those languages based upon historical events and contemporary events. And it's also Swahili and partisans of Swahili in all of its forms, or they come in a variety of forms, I should say. So partisans of Swahili come in a variety of forms. There are speakers who are very proud of speaking a dialect that is not standard. Then there are those who kind of champion the language as being something, they look to Tanzania as an example of the use of a language in order to create national unity. And these things are both true about the language. And it's this tension too, that is something that I was trying to not solve in the book, certainly. I don't think it's solvable, but to bring to light and to kind of pick apart a little bit and maybe explain a little bit why, where some of these tensions originated and then how they played out over the course of the history. Yeah. I should say too, in your initial question about the place of Swahili as a language in the mid-19th century in East Africa. It has a centuries-long history as a written language prior to that. And so among the associations that coastal dwellers in particular have with the language, there are traditions of legal thinking, philosophical thinking, poetry, art, that are no doubt a part of the history of Swahili, if one were to write the kind of long, all-encompassing history of it. But get a little bit, admittedly, kind of cut out of this book because of the focus on the standardization of it. But this is all kind of in the mixing pot when we speak of Swahili, particularly in the 19th century.
Right. I thought, you know, when I started reading the book, oh, the history of a language, you know, rather than the history of a country or the history of a movement.
Sure.
Or, oh, wow, what an easy register. right? And of course, not at all. It's even, sure. It's even more complex and amorphous.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that's so maybe kind of drew me to this project originally, and that I find so compelling about language, however you want to study it. It's central to who we are as human beings. Like, we don't think too much about the words that come out of our mouth, except for if you're being recorded for a podcast. But it is central to our identity in so many different ways, and just our daily functioning in the world, that it, as a historian, it's maybe the best topic out there, because it gives you your social history, your economic history, your political, your cultural history. And so language as an entree, although I've had to kind of continually defend myself about not knowing anything about linguistics, really, except for sort of layman's knowledge, the history of language can offer this beautiful entree into all sorts of historical questions.
Yeah, and the central one, which, you know, we mentioned before, the central one is the question of power. And yeah. I think that this is such an interesting book, because we're used to thinking about those debates in colonial and post-colonial Africa around the languages of the metropole, around sure. the debates around English, whether it can be Africanized, whether it can mm-hmm. be emancipatory, whether it's just going to repeat colonial legacies about French, about Portuguese. And yeah. this Swahili is just comes from such a different history, is so complex, has so many yeah. different players, that yeah. it offers us a really interesting entree into this question. And yeah. the way that you suggest we think about the complexity of power and the history of Swahili is to not to decide that this is a top-down or a bottom-up story, mm-hmm. not to put your stake in the ground to say, well, this has to be one way or the other, but to accept its complexity. And you offer us yeah. a metaphor in order to accept that complexity, which I think is one of the things that will travel beyond the history Swahili of your book, which is you offer us this lovely phrase, the duck rabbit moment.
Yes.
So you have to
yes.
tell us about this.
Yes. The duck rabbit. I wish this is the only moment of this podcast where I wish we had a visual, but right. It's this image that appears to some viewers. It's a drawing. One of the original copies of it is from, I believe, a 19th century German newspaper, but it comes in many forms, and I'm sure many people have seen it. It's an image that looks to some viewers like a duck and to some viewers like a rabbit, right? So it's either a beak or ears. And there's something powerful, I would argue, about this metaphor. I should also say it's a metaphor that's borrowed from the history of science. I am not the first to use it in terms of discussing flows of power and sort of observation that move in different directions. Thomas Kuhn, hats off. But I find it very useful to for talking about this particular story, because both are true. Once, if you see the rabbit first, and then someone says, no, it's a duck, and then you see the duck yourself, you see that both are there. And it's the only way that I could really feel comfortable describing this history of standard Swahili, because it is at once the language of colonial empire, no doubt about it. It is also the language of anti-colonial protest. It is a potential language of Pan-African unity, and it is also a language that is, the term language death I hate, but that is forcing speakers of some smaller local languages to choose to not speak their language anymore, right? So it is a force that whose power does move in multiple directions and has throughout the course of its history. So the duck rabbit is just a nice kind of, I think, efficient way to express what would otherwise take a historian maybe 5 minutes to explain what they're talking about.
Well, I'm going to put it in my pocket and take it to go.
Take it,
the yes. duck rabbit moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back to the chronology of the book. We are mm-hmm. in the 1860s. We're in Zanzibar. The UMCA sets up its headquarters there. And, you know, as you describe it, there's going to be kind of the rivalry between the Mombasa dialect of Swahili and the Zanzibar dialect of Swahili. And of course, it's mm-hmm. not clear or inevitable that the Zanzibar dialect Kiungani is the one that will eventually win out, so to speak. And you tell us this story. So why did the UMCA end up on Zanzibar? And what were their initial, what was their initial work with regard to standardizing Swahili?
Sure, sure. The history of the UMCA and its early years, there's a great book, Landeg White, Magomero, and he tells the story of the early years of the UMCA, which were disastrous. As the name suggests, they were initially trying to evangelize in Central Africa. They went up the Zambezi River and they were headed toward the Great Lakes. And it did not go well. They got involved in some local warfare. Some missionaries were killed. At one point, Livingston comes through. I believe he is even, there are people who know more about this than I, but I believe he makes contact with the missionaries when he's very ill. So they're seeing the great explorer sort of in his last days. Some of the missionaries themselves become ill and they basically have to retreat. And in mid-19th century East Africa, if you are a British missionary, and you have to retreat to safer ground, quote unquote, Zanzibar is the place that you go. It's the place that at this period of time is incredibly well connected to the world. You, very soon after their arrival, you get regular connections via steamships. Eventually in the 1870s, 1880s, telegraph cables get laid. And so that on top of the growing infrastructure of consulates on Zanzibar, because of its role as a trade center, meant that when they had to kind of retreat to lick their wounds, Zanzibar was the place they went to. It worked out well for the UMCA because by being on Zanzibar in the mid-19th century, they encountered the language that would allow them to speak with potential adherents across the region. And so almost right, it's this moment of historical contingency. Their arrival on Zanzibar in August 1864 really did give the UMCA this key with which they unlocked, yes, certainly fairly successful kind of evangelizing mission, but also laying the material basis through their handbooks and their vocabularies for what would be adopted as standard Swahili in the 20th century.
And of course, as you mentioned in the beginning, your question, how did these missionaries begin to learn this language? Of course, the missionaries are really the sideshow to the real teachers.
Absolutely. It's another sort of what makes this story so fun to tell is that these traditional roles get flipped. The teachers become the students and the students become the teachers. These missionaries are arriving with little to no prior exposure to Swahili. At this time, the trade in enslaved people in the Indian Ocean, the British Empire is trying to tamp it down. And so a lot of their first students are formerly enslaved young people who had been quote unquote liberated by the Royal Navy and then get dropped off on Zanzibar into the care of the mission. And so they are suddenly dealing with these young people who come from a huge variety of linguistic backgrounds, more or less, again, prior exposure to Swahili. And they slowly begin learning the language from these students, as well as from some important high status Zanzibaris. So the UMCA is kind of getting these linguistic inputs from, let's say, all sides of the spectrum of Swahili. And they're starting to kind of triangulate towards their mission, which is to be able to communicate with people, ultimately to translate the Bible, and be able to hopefully evangelize more broadly throughout the region. But it's those early years, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, when they're trying to do the initial work of translating certainly biblical texts, but also some secular texts for the classroom, that you can see this beautifully kind of iterative process of language learning and language teaching that's happening within the classrooms of the mission on Zanzibar.
As you're speaking, actually, something that I am not sure that I picked up on the book, but I'm hearing as you're speaking, there's something very interesting about the Swahili that the mission will end up standardizing in the sense that it's actually cross-class, right? It's not just people, speakers from all different parts of the region. It's actually, if you have the kind of court scholarly language, and then you have the language of formerly enslaved young people whose maybe it's their second or their third language. Yeah. You really have, that's super interesting. You know, I hadn't really picked up on that.
But
I want to invite you to give us maybe an example of this kind of teaching process, teaching from below, perhaps we might call it. And how do the students really tell them, let the missionaries know where they're erring on?
I mean, there's lots of, you know, missionaries, they write everything down and they write to each other. So there's great sources for actually getting at what this process looked like. So there's a ton of examples of, for instance, the missionaries being warned of bad words, whether that's obscene words in some cases, or just words that don't quite fit in the missionaries' translations. The discussion about how to translate the word for priest was also something that was obviously very important to the missionaries, but there's a series of letters between two of the missionaries, Edward Steer and Lewin Pennell. This is in the 1870s. And these were the two who were both involved very much with the translation projects of the mission, but they were also in the classroom. They were doing the teaching at the high school on Zanzibar. And they're talking about, okay, well, how do we translate this word for priest? They're writing letters because Steer was on leave back in England. And Pennell's saying, well, I asked these students, the sort of people that I was speaking to, and they suggested these words. But then I asked the Qadi, because they were working with a legal scholar on Zanzibar as well. And he says that perhaps these words might imply the idea of a soothsayer or someone who is engaging in kind of traditional practices of telling the future. Certainly not something we would want the notion of priest to be associated with. And so after this kind of series of back and forth, they're trying really hard to find a Swahili word for this. They end up with this word kasisi, which is a word that they use in subsequent translations of the word priest, but they use it interchangeably with padiri, which is on its surface, right, linked to padre. I admit that I'm not exactly sure whether that was a direct borrowing from maybe Portuguese or whether this is also leftovers from other kind of language contact. But for the first few years, they're kind of using both of these words interchangeably until kasisi becomes the word that they use in the majority of their translations for priest. So that's one where the feedback from their various interlocutors helped them triangulate a word that would express the meaning that they want to have without potentially reflecting prior beliefs. That's what they're really nervous about. I mean, these missionaries are even very willing to borrow words with Islamic connotations. They would rather that than words with connotations in terms of sort of local or prior religious beliefs. So that's one of the sort of kind of stories of iterative language learning. And if you'll indulge me, just one more example about word choice, particularly. That prior example was one that's really, it was determined by the missionaries, right? The final choice of the word that would be entered in the dictionaries and put in the translations, it was their say. And that was the case ultimately in a lot of these discussions about language. But it wasn't always the case. The students did have the power to push back, in particular with the spoken language, right? That's much more difficult to control than the written language. So there's one example where a missionary priest is writing to his colleague and he says, you know, these students, they really have such a corrupt language. What started in play is now what they use more often than the proper Swahili word. So they use the word kuchenja. This is a construction out of the Swahili infinitive marker ku and a slightly modified version of the English verb change. So kuchenja. And the missionary says, they use this now instead of using kubadili, which means to change in Swahili. And yet it was a habit that he could not stamp out in his classrooms. And for me, this is just a clear example of the language being used among the students themselves for their own purposes. they are invested in the language and its communicative abilities in order to, I mean, think about it. These are, for the most part, formerly enslaved young people. They are using this language to rebuild a new community on Zanzibar. And yes, no doubt, they are invested in the mission's project of evangelization to some degree, by necessity, right? This is the landscape in which they find themselves. But they're also using the language sometimes in ways that are not the approved ways in order to make these connections amongst themselves. And so I think that's, again, I try as much as possible to pull some of these examples out in the book too, because as much as this is a story about standardization, which seems something that it seems to imply that the language becomes set in stone, it was never, ever set in stone. And the influences on the language and the people who were able to use it in creative ways and for their own purposes, I mean, there's just countless examples of that across this history.
And certainly if you are Swahilophone, this book is really rich with these kind of textured examples, which I can appreciate, but you know, only to some extent. So I really invite listeners who are Swahili speakers and readers to engage the text in that register. One word that I learned while reading this book was upelekwa, mm-hmm. which you tell us means community building. And I think this is the word that kind of designates the process that's happening while the missionaries are busy working on their dictionaries. What's really mm-hmm. happening in the mission amongst the African students, amongst the formerly enslaved and freeborn students, is the creation of a community, a network, which eventually becomes much larger than simply Zanzibar or simply mm-hmm. Tanganyika, and really extends even all the way to England. And you give us an example of Agnes Sapuli, who you have her letters, which is over the course of almost 20 years, which is really wonderful. And she is someone who is really actively engaged in this work of building community, of building upelekwa. So tell us a little about Agnes.
Yeah, one of my favorite sort of characters from the book, absolutely. I should say too that there are two other works that engage with and tell the story of Agnes Sapuli. One is Pollock and Russell's News from Masasi, and then Andreana Prichard's Sisters in Spirit also features Agnes to some degree. But obviously, all three of us are looking at this story from different angles. But Agnes Sapuli was a young woman who lived in what would become Tanganyika, near the Masasi station, which is in today what is southeastern Tanzania. And as a young girl, she lived near the mission station. She encountered the mission teachers early on, and she decided after a year or so of being in the mission school that she wanted to be baptized. And in the initial sort of letters, it's actually not Agnes writing, but it's her teacher who's writing to a potential sponsor in England, asking for support for this young student. This happened a lot with the UMCA. They had a fairly active home community that would sponsor even specific children. And so Agnes is ultimately named Agnes because she is sponsored by St. Agnes's Church in London. And this started, like you said, 20 years of correspondence between Agnes Sapuli and her sponsor in England, who he was the head of the parish at St. Agnes in London, Reverend Child. And Agnes was writing in Swahili. It's a question whether she was writing herself or whether she had an amanuensis. The handwriting does change sometimes. All the letters are in Oxford, and they include both a Swahili and an English version. So clearly there was some copying and translating going on. But the letters are remarkable for, first off, their linguistic sophistication. I mean, they are, you can read them like you would any other Swahili letter from the turn of the century until today. Also, her expressions of her sense of closeness to the parish in London, she feels that they are part of a single community. And what they are connected by is certainly their faith, but also this language that she is using to communicate with this priest in London. And then also just the reports of daily life from the region. I mean, the detail about whether it's famine in certain years, whether it's the visiting of people to the mission station and the kind of joy that brings, down to little greetings to specific people that are being sent back and forth. Again, they've never met each other, but there's a sense of intimacy that's remarkable in these letters. And it's all being done in Swahili. So Agnes Sapuli for me is one of the most sort of vivid examples that I have of the language being in use out of the control of the missionaries. No doubt she was married to a man who worked for the mission. The mission is her life. And yet she's using this language to build connections that really aren't at the behest of the UMCA necessarily. So this for me is a clear example of it being not just a top-down story, or not just even a story of the kind of upper crust of the mission learning and engaging with this language. It is starting to trickle down to users of the language, both written and spoken, across the region. Because I should mention too, by the 1870s, 1880s, the UMCA is opening up mission stations on the mainland as well. So by the late 1870s, they have missions as far west as Lake Nyasa, which is now Lake Malawi, right? So at this point, it really is becoming a regional force, the mission version of the language.
As you're talking about Agnes's letters, it just makes me nostalgic for that era of history writing, you know, the 1950s, 1960s, where people could just bang out a 600-page book without worrying about having an argument and put every last detail that they would like to put in there,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
You just want to hear all of those little details
for
that
sure.
Are in Agnes's letters, but you can in a monograph that has to be under 200 pages, right?
That's the thing. Well, I mean, a little plug, I did write an article about Agnes in the Journal for Eastern African Studies, but even there, you can't give all the detail. I mean, one has to be careful about, is it Jill Lepore who writes about finding a lock of, I don't know if it's Thomas Jefferson, somebody's hair in the archive, and suddenly having the desire to stroke it and thinking maybe I've gotten too close to my subject. That danger exists, but it does seem to me that Agnes was a remarkable figure. I don't know that she was exceptional. She could have been surrounded by dozens of other amazing teachers, mothers, wives, and sort of forces of nature in this region at the turn of the century, but she's the one who survived in the archive, right? Again, it's the contingency of that. And yeah, no, the stories are amazing. I mean, she was the mother of she gave birth to 6 children, only 2 of whom survived past childhood. She died during her 7th pregnancy. I mean, she survived World War I only to die in childbirth. Yeah, it's one of those stories where it's either totally inspirational or totally depressing, depending upon which day you kind of encounter it.
Right. Well, you mentioned World War I. Mm-hmm. So let's quickly address proportional, you know, to the time that it lasted, the German presence.
Sure.
On Zanzibar and in Tanganyika, and the Germans' relationship to Swahili.
Yeah. I think it was Derek Peterson who wrote that German language policy was desultory. And I think that kind of sums it up. Though the Germans were among the sort of leading academics in terms of comparative linguistics in this period, no doubt. They're interested in Bantu languages. But on the ground, there was not a set policy for standardization. Swahili was the language of administration during most of the German period. But because of tensions back in Berlin and realities on the ground, that was never really stated. I mean, there were some interest groups in Germany that wanted German to be the language of the German Empire. And then there's other interest groups that think that German needs to be reserved for settlers, for instance. And so those tensions within the sort of German political spectrum led to a situation wherein, yes, de facto, Swahili was the language of administration, but de jure, it was not written necessarily until towards the very end of the German period. And then Yeah, they lose their colonies. And so that what might have been then a push towards standardization gets cut short.
And who is there to pick up the baton?
But the British.
But the British. That's yes. Right.
Yes, yes.
So 1925, exactly. The Interterritorial Language Committee is convened. And this is going to mm-hmm. be the body that from the interwar period until the basically through World War II is going to be kind of the bureaucratic entity that works on the standardization project. And so it's bringing together now not just linguists from one mission or another, but mm-hmm. officials who are representing the four territories, or Tanganyika, exactly. Zanzibar, Kenya, and Uganda.
Exactly.
And trying to stamp to decide what's the dialect, what exactly is the Swahili that we're going to use administratively, bureaucratically. Mm-hmm. And you know, the passions are inflamed because, of course, each dialect and each standardization project represents so much labor and so much anguish and so much yes. investment on behalf of the missions. And in the end, the Zanzibar dialect wins out over the Mombasa dialect, for example. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. one of the missionaries who's been so deeply invested in the Mombasa dialect is so overwhelmed that you say he has to be led out of the room in tears.
Reportedly, that is the case. Yes, yes. Tensions ran high. And I think it's particularly telling too that these decisions got made at an education conference. So this 1925 conference was called by River Smith, who was in charge of the education department in Tanganyika. And it was really Swahili, or I should say the choice of a language of education was just one of the many issues that they were discussing. But it was naturally a part of the conversations that they were going to have, because in order to standardize their education, they felt they needed their education system and offerings and expectations. They had to standardize the language of instruction and assessment. And so it was in that context that a special committee on standardization was set, and they made the decision, and they referenced specifically the UMCA. They say that they will use the handbook of the UMCA, the grammar of Skier, and the handbook of AC Medin in order to serve as the basis of standard Swahili. And this is, as you say, you read the book very hard. I'm very impressed. As you say, this is the moment where it becomes an official project, right? Whereas before it had been semi-official, this project of standardization had been at once missionary driven, but also clearly the participants go much wider than that. Here it becomes an official body that will then be tasked with quote unquote capital S standardization.
And like the Berlin conference or the Brazzaville conference, there, except for Felix Eboué, there's no Africans present yes. on this body until 1939.
Yes, on the ILC. Yes, there were two East Africans present at the initial 1925 conference, but no, there were no Africans appointed to the ILC until 1939. And of course, that was wartime. So they didn't have any meetings until 1945 anyway. So there was no African official, I should say, participation until that 1945 meeting.
Okay, so let's take the story into the post-war period. At this point, there are Swahili, English, Swahili dictionaries mm-hmm. that have been published, Swahili also.
Right.
And so to some extent, you could say that at least the kind of baseline of the standardization project has been established, even as we know sure. that it's an ever ongoing and like sort of impossible actual task to complete.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
But what the British are turning their attention to is now less so the codification and more, as you write, the creation mm-hmm. of literature and materials in the Swahili language. And so they try to incentivize Africans to write creatively and produce materials in Swahili so that they can spread and inculcate the habit of Swahili literacy.
Right.
This is very much also part of a kind of developmentalist project after World War II. The Colonial Welfare and Development Act funds mm-hmm. are actually important for sponsoring these projects. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how they try to solicit these writing contributions and the kind of complexities that they open up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the ways that the entrees that I found into this question, right, this move from codification to creation, were the essay contests that first the ILC and then its sister department. It's an organization that came after the war, the East African Literature Bureau. It was created after the war. Started off as kind of an equal with the ILC, but then as this move from codification to creation became more the focus of colonial policy in the region at this period, it started to get certainly more attention and also more funding from the colonial state. So the East African Literature Bureau took over from the ILC the hosting of these essay contests. How the essay contests were advertised was mainly in the bulletin of the ILC. So I certainly can't make the argument that it was a kind of territory-wide call that every school child would have encountered. So for the most part, the people who ended up contributing to these essay contests were teachers within government schools or the sort of upper class students. And they ran the gamut. There would be contests for set topics. It would be things like, how do you celebrate Christmas in your community? Or what is typical seasonal harvest in your community? These sort of like maybe kind of ethnographic type of questions. And then they started over the years too to open up these kind of open topics and to even encourage fiction writing. And you can see in because within the documents of the East African Literature Bureau, there are some of the assessments of the essays that we received. And there is this tug of war between wanting a quote unquote authentic African voice with quote unquote authentic African topics, right? I hope that the listener can hear the sarcasm gripping in my voice. And also this desire to, they're also looking for creativity. And how they define that is never clear. Does that mean that you have to be creative within the bounds that the Literature Bureau accepts as traditional? Does it mean following British or English Anglophone models? Were they willing to award brand new forms of literature and writing? And it's a constant tension within the assessments of these essays as they're coming in. And I'm sure for the writers would have been kind of frustrating. It's right, you know, you constantly have one reviewer who wants one thing and one reviewer who wants another, and they're irreconcilable. We all know that story. But there are some great literary figures who came out of these contests. Among them, Chaban Robert, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o contributed while he was at McCrary. He contributed to one of the essay contests of the East African Literature Bureau. Muhammad Abdullah, one of his early detective novels that was set on Zanzibar came through one of these Literature Bureau contests. And so here we are again with a duck rabbit, right? The colonial entity that is sponsoring writing contests in a particular kind of Swahili, right? They want Swahili. They did work in other languages too. There were contests for other languages, but for the Swahili contest, they want a particular kind of Swahili, which is to say standard Swahili. And yet these authors are able to, within those constraints, write things that, you know, I think any of us would be loath to call toady, right? I mean, they are, Chaban Robert, one of the most kind of subversive writers, I think, in standard Swahili. And yet some of his early writing was happening with the Literature Bureau. And so again, what do we have here? Do we have power? Do we have emancipatory power or oppressive power? We have both happening at the same time. And it should also be attributed to the greatness of these writers that they are able to, within these constraints, create what is literature that stands up to this day.
So I guess at this point, we are getting towards the late colonial period. And beyond this aspect of literary creation, there's also the legal political context, right? Rising demands for independence, or at least rising nationalism, and then maybe later demands for independence. And Swahili plays a role in this, in that there's really claims for the colonial state to be more transparent with its legal structures through translation.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of one of the shocking things. You go into, you sort of start a project and you don't always know the things that will become kind of some of the most important building blocks of the argument, but it's a shocking fact that the British colonial regime in East Africa did not have a set policy of translation into Swahili, despite Swahili being one of the official languages of administration throughout the period. It was not until there were constant calls for the translation of laws and regulations into Swahili. And it wasn't until the 1950s that it even started really happening with any regularity at all. And it certainly wasn't until the independence period that laws started to be systematically translated into Swahili. And so I kind of liken it to this. We talk a lot about how the notion of citizenship in the sort of the anti-colonial period and towards the independence period was a sort of transformative notion, right? To go from a colonial subject to a citizen means that one is making perhaps different kind of demands on the state, and that when the citizen suddenly starts to demand independence, right? This is this kind of sea change towards the move towards anti-colonialism. And there is with Swahili, it becomes this kind of, it becomes this avenue of linguistic citizenship, I would say, that people are, and these are mainly people certainly who are already engaged with the state in some way. Your clerks, interpreters, people who are working in the court system, they're the ones who see the kind of importance and the justice that would come via translation and the injustice that is done when a citizenry cannot read the laws that govern it. And so I think that in this last chapter, the argument I'm trying to make is that alongside these other notions of citizenship that is leading people to call for the ouster of the colonial state, their linguistic citizenship is one of them. And that Swahili really, it was the language with which people were making demands, but also about which they were making demands.
Well, I wanted to close, since this is a book essentially, you know, about Tanzania, with the linguistic story of Julius Nyerere, the first president, and his relationship to Swahili, which you bring to us. It's just a remarkable anecdote.
Yeah. So early on, Nyerere is doing these kind of political safaris around the country, trying to draw up support for TANU, the Tanganyika African National Union, the Party of Independence. And on these political safaris, he is using Swahili. And indeed, Nyerere, a scholar in so many ways, he had, as part of one of his degrees, he had translated a couple of works of Shakespeare into Swahili. And so he's clearly, he can handle his Swahili. And yet, Bibi Titi Mohamed, who was another member of TANU, another major political figure in the 1950s and in the independence period in Tanganyika, she claimed later in life that she had taught Nyerere Swahili. And it seems at once this remarkable statement, right? This man who had translated Shakespeare into Swahili. And yet her point is that Nyerere had a by-the-book Swahili. He had learned it. It was not his first language. He had learned it in school, and he couldn't maybe connect with his listeners in the way that she thought he would need to in order to be able to become this political force. And so he had to learn his Swahili again from Bibi Titi. And so I also think that this this moment, besides being this wonderful indication of the importance of the female nationalists, which there's fantastic Susan Geiger book about this, right? It's fantastic, right? How important the women were to Tanganyika nationalism. It also is an indicator to us of how many different registers of Swahili existed and still do exist in East Africa. Yes, it was the language of Tanu. Yes, it was the language of anti-colonial nationalism. Yes, it was standardized, quote unquote, by this time. And yet, what kind of Swahili you're using in any given situation, you still had to have a gut feeling for that. And you still had to have the linguistic capabilities to change your register. And so Nyerere, who's given all the credit for bringing Tanzania together as a nation with the language, which no doubt, right? It was a powerful decision that was made in this period. He had to learn his Swahili from BBTT.
Yeah, it's such an evocative anecdote for me because it also almost seems like it's a way of reading the kind of demissionification of Swahili, right?
Yes, he had to that's kind right. of
unlearn his mission, learned Swahili to learn the language of the people that he wanted to govern, or you know, that
that was he had to learn it from a Muslim woman.
That's right, the anti white man Christian mission, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, Nyerere's decision to use Swahili in governance and his Pan-Africanist project also really inspires Black cultural nationalists outside of East Africa, including in the United States. And, you know, there is a coda to your book is about also the creation of Kwanzaa, the holiday in the United States, and how Swahili becomes... the Swahili terms that are part of the Kwanzaa ceremony become appropriated to index a Pan-African global African, global Black freedom.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And Karenga, the leader of an organization called US here in the States, and the founder of Kwanzaa, he even said specifically that he had chosen Swahili not because it was a heritage language for himself or most Black Americans, but rather because it was supra-tribal in a way, because it had this, if it could bring together so many different kinds of people in Africa, maybe it could do the same for his movement. And so again, the symbolic power of Swahili, it's another chapter in the symbolic power of this language, as well as the practical power. I think those things also have to be said together always. It is not simply a symbolic language because it is a powerful practical tool and has been throughout this long, long history.
Morgan, it has been so much fun to talk to you about this book, this project that I've tangentially seen develop over the last 10 years.
You have. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Yeah.
It's really a lovely book. And I just want to impress upon listeners that this conversation has been really easy to have and really flowed because the book is so well written.
Morgan's really a
wonderful prose stylist, and it's very readable and it's super interesting. And if your interest has been piqued, I really recommend picking it up and spending some time with it.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and this is such a wonderful venue for these conversations. And I should say too, it is available for free download on the website of Ohio University Press. So people should go and download it and pass it along as much as they would like.
Fantastic. So Morgs, this is the second podcast that we've recorded
Indeed.
In our illustrious history.
Our career, our audio career.
So I really look forward to our third sometime down the line.
Yes.
Thank you for talking to us about your wonderful new book, A Language for the World. And I'm looking forward to the next one.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk in 10 years.